Hey, it's Glenn Thrush here with Politico's weekly podcast, Off Message. And a special treat this week, got to sit down with Paul Ryan, the probably the first head-banging House Ways and Means chairman in United States history. We discovered pretty shortly into this interview, which lasted a good 40, 45 minutes, and which took place in the Ways and Means conference room, right off the floor of the House of Representatives. It was right in the middle of a vote, so there was a big crowd outside. But we started talking. Within 4 or 5 minutes, we both realized how much we loved Metallica, which I didn't really anticipate when you're talking with a guy who sort of prides himself on being an economics geek. He also loves Zeppelin, but it was the Metallica thing that really knocked me off my pegs. Well, anyway, Ryan is one of the few Republicans, it seems, that had the discipline to sit out the 2016 race, and he talks a lot about why he chose to do that. And in the middle of the conversation, he offered some pretty interesting and completely unsolicited advice to Hillary Rodham Clinton. So here's Paul Ryan. So why don't we just sort of start off with where you're from?
So I live in Janesville, Wisconsin. It's a town in south central Wisconsin, about 60,000 people. It's where I grew up. I live on the block I grew up on. In my neighborhood, within about 10 blocks of my house are 8 other Ryan family households.
No kidding.
And my brother lives a block away. My aunt and uncle are across the street. My cousin's next door. I come from a big Irish Catholic extended family. We've been in this town since 1850s. So we're famine Irish. So potato famine. James Ryan.
Have you traced it all the way?
Yeah, we traced all of it. We just did this recently. A couple years ago, we figured it out. So James and Catherine Ryan came over from County Kilkenny in 1851 out of Cork. You know, in one of those famine ships. They call them coffin ships in the days.
That's the West, right?
What's that?
Cork is in the West, right?
It's in the South. It's south central. And they went to Canada and then made it to Wisconsin and got a farm outside of Janesville, Wisconsin. And my family's been there ever since.
That's amazing. Very few people have that kind of continuity, right?
Yeah, that's right. Janesville's like that. It's a town of it actually is a fairly Irish town. It's a town, you know, you had just clusters of immigrants. That's what Wisconsin, a lot of America's like that. Wisconsin is very much like that. So Janesville became an Irish immigrant cluster town. A lot of my family went away to college, went away to work on the East or the West Coast, and many people just ultimately returned to Janesville because the quality of life. They just loved it because the pull of home. It's a very strong community, and it's a place where people want to raise their kids.
One of your parents was political, right? Served on a school board?
The Catholic school board, yeah. My mom, she was a very involved person, very civically involved person, but I would not call her political at all. She served on the school board because her kids were in school.
And, so how'd you get
it? Was the Catholic school board, just the local, you know, school
board. But how'd
you
get the bug? Because clearly, I mean, this is...
Yeah, I come from a very apolitical family. I mean, there were Republicans. My dad was a big Reagan fan. But I just got into... Actually, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a doctor like my grandfather on my mom's side. I got into it because I just fell in love with economics. And I thought I was going to go... into economics.
Okay, let me just ask you. You said you fell in love with economics.
Yeah. Is that weird?
Yes, it's weird.
I just did. My brothers majored in it. I'm young, the youngest by 5 years. So both my brothers majored in it and sort of led me into
was it initially sort of the Viennese
school? The Austrians are what I was very interested in.
Well, in high school is when you started, when you read Ayn Rand for the first time.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. You're doing that urban legend.
That's not true.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's true. People hype this thing up a lot. Yes, I did.
Well, Rush. You're a rock fan, right?
Do
you ever listen to Rush?
Yeah. I listened to Rush when I was Rush the band. Yeah, I listened to Rush when I was in high school.
Good distinction there.
Yeah.
Well, Neil Peart, the drummer for Rush, who wrote all the lyrics, you know, wrote like one record that was based because he was really into Atlas Shrugged. And it was just one record.
I didn't know that.
And he said everyone just keeps asking me about Ayn Rand. Yeah. It was like that was 3 weeks out of my life.
There's my story. Yeah. So I enjoyed the Lavals quite a bit. It triggered my interest in economics.
Right.
And that's where I got into the Austrians, and that's where I got into Milton Friedman, the Chicago School, basically.
Did you ever, for instance, I mean, like...
But did I ever, like, flirt with objectivism? No, I thought it was beyond the pale, but... But
have you ever talked to Rand Paul about this stuff? I mean, this is obviously something
not about
guys,
this. I talked to him about a lot of things, but I've never talked to him about that.
Why is objectivism not something that ever really attracted
I believe
you?
In God, for one. Objectivism is just a philosophy I do not comport with at all. We would take the entire interview going into this if you want to.
No, but, I don't.
If you're going to give me some an epistemological perspective, give me Thomas Aquinas. Don't give me Ayn Rand.
So you are somebody, you're steeped in sort of the Catholic. In terms of, were you a wide reader when you were a kid?
I read a lot when I was a kid.
Did you ever, for instance, because we talk about the Austrians.
Right, Churchill. My dad was a huge Churchill fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's why you see a bus there, one over here. I read Churchill when I was young. I read just about everything I could get my hands on, particularly after my dad's death. I got into like sort of introspection, I guess.
No kidding. Yeah. Like what kind of stuff did you read right after that?
Just about everything. And I read lots of history, lots of philosophy, lots of economics. I read a whole sampling of it all. Because I was sort of searching just for knowledge.
You read sort of the liberal classics? I'll throw one at you, like the Zinn book, The People's History of the United States.
No, but I read Camus. I read Freud and Feuerbach, all that stuff, which is a bunch of gobbledygook in my opinion, but it's good to read that stuff.
You don't like Freud? You don't think it's... I think Freud's...
It's interesting.
It's really well written.
It's interesting. I read a bunch... But I read... the point is, I read not just conservative or libertarian stuff. I read a lot of different things.
So as you got into politics, you know, it's really funny. Like, you will talk to politicians about books. I remember interviewing a candidate for the mayoralty in New York, and he said, I want to talk about books, and the guy was not really a reader. A lot of politicians talk about books, but books are important to you, right? Still.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have as much time like I used to have. That's one thing I kind of, among the things I wish I had more time for is to read. So I do a lot of listening on tape. I spend a lot of time driving around.
So you listen.
So I do lectures and things like that on tape.
Anything recent that struck
you? I do these learning, the teaching courses, and this is not a paid advertising for,
but
it's a really cool program. They pull across the country for the best professors,
right.
And then they put their lectures on tape, and then I listen to those. And typically, I do economics and history and just other interesting stuff. So,
is there anybody in Congress right now who you consider to be kind of somebody you talk with a lot about this stuff? Is there somebody you find really intellectually interesting? Doesn't have to be a Republican, obviously.
I better answer this question because if I do. So I'm just kidding.
No one's going to listen to this except you and me.
Yeah, right. Sure. Nothing jumps to the top of my head. But Tom McClintock and I have had some really interesting conversations over the years.
About what kind of stuff?
Just a lot of these things. He's an interesting guy. I used to talk to Ron Paul about this stuff when I was young.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because he's such a well-read guy on libertarian issues.
Right.
So I'd always just pick his brain and just kick his tires and get his take on things.
What's that like?
He's fun to talk to. He's a neat guy. He's a fun guy to talk to.
Do you remember anything specific that you kind of...
I used to always talk to him about monetary policy, things like that.
Do you generally agree with his philosophy on stuff? It seems like there's a little bit of a divergence, right?
I'm not... It depends on the issue. We'd have to go through issue. Some yes, some no. I guess I'd say... The people on my committee are the people I spend most of my time with, that I talk with, and we have Ways and Means Committee has really talented people, very talented people, and good members who just have a lot. They're among our best members of the conference.
One of the things I noticed as a reporter, and everybody does when they're up here, is how you would glide by listening to music. I mean, I've been asked a zillion questions about music. Do you play music?
Yeah. Yes.
What do you?
Oh,
play?
Do I play? You mean?
Yeah, like actually play.
The cowbell. Yeah.
So you like Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah, that's right.
So you are a Zeppelin
no,
fan.
No, I don't. Yeah, I am a big Zeppelin.
Zeppelin's your number one?
If you had to be
one
group, I'd pick Zeppelin.
What's your favorite Zeppelin song?
Out of the Gallows Pole is probably the current one.
No kidding.
It bounces around.
A little acoustic-y for me.
Yeah, I like it. I move around.
You're not a When the Levee Breaks kind of guy?
That was my favorite song.
Seems very fiscal to me.
But I listened to it so much that...
Me too. And it's one chord.
I move off another one. But I really like... That was my favorite one for a long time.
My kids like that one. Do your kids like Can you get your kids into Zeppelin?
We have a rule in our family, which is if Led Zeppelin's on the radio, you cannot change the station.
And you cannot talk.
And you cannot talk. So that's my rule, because my daughter, she's not into Led Zeppelin, let's just say that. She's into what 13-year-old girls are into. So,
which is what?
I don't know. We share the same iTunes account, so I get all these things coming onto my device here that I have never ever seen and heard before. I have very eclectic tastes. I like country, old country, new country.
Like what? Like Bob Wills.
Old stuff like Hank Jr. Here, I'll pull up my playlist.
Hank Jr. is not old.
That's old to me. No, that's Hank Jr. is old. Well, I think these days you would call Hank Jr. old.
Hank Sr. is old.
No, but that's. That's really old country. Let's just call that really old country.
Okay,
old country.
So when you were out on the trail,
new country is Miranda Lambert, Dustin Lynch, Florida Georgia Band, Justin Moore. He's pretty good. But I'm really more of a classic rock guy and a little bit of headbanger. I've got a lot of Metallica on here.
You like Metallica?
I've liked Metallica since Ride the Lightning came out in 1984 or something.
My first job was I was senior editor of Guitar World magazine under the nom de plume Glenn Thrash. And I hung out with Pantera and Iron Maiden.
No kidding.
A little bit of Metallica.
Seen Iron Maiden twice in concert in high school.
Yeah, and I was a mostly...
Did you see Eddie?
Eddie walking around.
Yeah.
They're all about 5'4" tall.
Yeah. I've seen those. I went to all those concerts. In high school, it was Def Leppard, Iron Maiden, Ozzy Osbourne, Metallica, that kind of stuff.
I was
if
a motor,
you grew up in Wisconsin, that's pretty much what you
I was a Motorhead guy. I was in Motorhead cover bands, but where I was from, thrash was like a big, thrash was just starting in hardcore. Speaking of thrash and hardcore, let's talk a little bit about 2012.
Okay.
So that must have been an out-of-body experience. I mean, in general, as you look back, what is the big takeaway? I never want to do that again?
No, I actually liked the experience, on the net.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great experience. I learned a lot. It's not my natural thing. I'm more of a policy person than a political person.
Right.
At least that's how I see myself. Maybe some people see me differently. So I've always been more of a kind of a cause guy, policy person. But it was fun. And it's one of those deals where you have 6 days' notice. I mean, I got between when Mitt asked me and this thing was made public, we were basically stuffed into a cannon and shot out to the country. It was a lot of learning on the job. And thank God I had 14 years of experience in Congress under my belt.
But what was the...
out there,
On
your own. You have support staff, but you have to... It's you, And every local and regional reporter trying to make a name to trip you up or to catch you or something like that. So you just get kind of... But I had already 14 years of that doing all my budgets.
You get kind of guarded, yeah.
Yeah, but if I hadn't had the experiences I had before with budget, with just being in Congress, with... representing a swing district, doing over 700 town hall meetings, that would have been a really hard thing to do. As a result, once I got the tempo of it in the first, 3-4 weeks, it became fun. My kids loved it. They thought it was great.
Was there any moment early on, particularly dealing with the press, you mentioned people trying to make their name, that you were like, man, I'm sorry I got into this?
No, I was like, man, I screwed up and I got to fix, I got to get better. You know what I mean? I would just get down on myself.
Are you tough on yourself in that regard?
Yeah.
Like, what is it like? Because I don't deal with the media, thank God, apart from the time I'm standing in front of a mirror, which is bad enough. But what is it like to deal with us and how has it changed? You said you've done it for 14 years.
I'm in my 17th now.
Right. What was it like? What was it like to sort of face the pack? Was it...
Well, I'd done a little bit of that, but nothing like this. I mean, it's not, they don't really compare. Being senator, governor, or house leader, or chairman, it doesn't compare to a presidential. Presidential is very different. And to me, the big takeaway I get out of this, and people ask me this, guys who are running for president, is you can't let the process numb you to the point where you're just a robot. You've got to maintain your individuality. You have to maintain your personality. Even though all the pressure is don't gaffe, don't deviate, be prepared, give the prepared thing. You got to watch that because you can just be boring and you can be vanilla and you can so sanitize yourself that you're not yourself.
Right.
Now, when you're on the ticket, meaning the running mate,
right.
You don't want to screw up another person's campaign. My big concern at the time was Mitt's been running for this thing for 6 years.
Right.
I'm on board for the last 3 months. I don't want to screw up his what he's been doing.
Was there a moment that you, is there a moment you can look back on where you thought you came close to screwing up?
No, there really wasn't. We had a really good team. I mean, our you know, you read about in these campaign books about infighting and stuff like that. Right. We didn't have that. We right. I mean, he was there. I mean, we had a very good team, very good relationships. There was none of that issue whatsoever. And again, because I had good experience, because our team was, you know, it was a team that they assembled for me, but it was all house people. It was Buck, it was Steele, you know, it was, you know, Dan Senor, who's a buddy of mine, you know, just, so it was, we had a very good team, and there was no daylight between his team and my team. They were, and we were talked every single day, integrated. So I felt like I was just a key part of a really good team moving in the same direction.
No.
But the pressure for me was, he put so much into this. I want to contribute to make sure that this campaign's successful, and I don't want to do anything to deviate from that.
But the interesting thing about you is, like, you're a very disciplined person, mm-hmm. and I think that came through on the campaign, and it advantaged you tremendously. But talk about a little bit about it, you were in an interesting situation, and it wasn't necessarily what you did or what you said, but it was your budget that really became the issue.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah. And when he asked me, I said, "You realize, I mean, I'm the guy with all the budget cuts. You put me on the ticket. You own this budget." He said, "Well, I'm going to own it anyway, so might as well put the guy on the ticket who can best defend it and who knows it." And he basically gave me this long talk about, this is what we have to do to save the country,
right.
And I want to save the country, and you know how to do these things in Congress. I know business, I know economics, you know Congress, you know the federal government and the budgets. He said, "You compliment my weaknesses, and so that's why I want you to be on the ticket." And so that was a pretty good, I thought that was a fairly compelling.
Now, as you know, the Democrats point. loved your budget, and they loved.
I did too.
When they, that's right.
You know, I like that. I want debates like that.
So you were eager to have that debate.
I was excited about that. I went around Florida with my mom doing Medicare town hall meetings. I was using Jumbotrons in Central Florida University in the basketball arena with Medicare charts. I mean, for me, that was fun. So. The other big takeaway is, other than work hard at being yourself,
yeah.
and don't let the pressure of a campaign so sanitize you. I think this is Hillary Clinton's problem.
Right.
Hillary Clinton is so handled, so managed, so sanitized. I don't know where's the real human being here.
Did you buy, were you watching any of the coverage of her out in
Iowa? Yeah, I did. I watched a little bit of it.
Yeah. And what do you think? I mean, do you think there is an authentic person in there?
I haven't seen it yet. Look, I don't really know her. I mean, I know her a little bit, so I'm not going to make a personal thing. But you know, if you got the New York, if you're calling the New York Times to tell them that you ate at Chipotle, please go. You know,
I will tell you from personal knowledge, because the reporter who wrote that story is my best friend. She didn't call. She discovered that on her own. I will tell you.
Oh, okay. Yes. That's not what's out there.
No, that's wrong.
Oh,
she
good to know.
I don't want you to.
No, I appreciate that.
No, mind you, I would love for you to, you know, swing wildly and miss, but you know.
Yeah. No, listen, I appreciate that. That's what I read.
Yeah,
I don't know, maybe in Politico.
Yeah. Well, you can't.
Just
well,
kidding.
I'm not going to say anything against Politico. But
the point I'm saying is,
yeah.
So when I have a new view of how I look at these candidates, so I see her, and I see. In her mind are all the people telling her, "Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that, be this, be that, be this, be that." And she's probably going through all these cycles of those thoughts and doing that.
So you can sort of see her as you're sort of looking in those eyes and seeing that, because you went through the same thing yourself.
And my advice to anybody running for president is just reject that stuff and just be you. People are going to see through, you know, they'll see who you are at the end of the day and get them there at the beginning of the day.
But authenticity, which has become the byword right now, is a tricky thing.
You got to be one to lose.
Right.
That's the problem in politics, is people who are so fueled by ambition that the ambition is everything. You got to be willing to lose these jobs if you want to be good at these jobs. So the way I decided a number of years ago, I got to be willing to lose this job if I want to be really good at this job. And that includes if you're running for president. That, to me, gives you the mental edge and gives you the sense of authenticity that people so desperately need in this country. And I don't see that. The point I'm making about Hillary Clinton is I don't see that in her.
Okay, bookmark that point for 1 second. Because I want to go back to it. But you're sort of talking about the willingness to lose. But there, you know, I just did a story on Speaker Boehner a couple of months ago, you know, sort of talking about how difficult a challenge he faces. And you've been savaged on some of these votes and stuff.
Yeah, kind of get used to it.
But isn't there a cohort in your party that it seems very willing to lose? In fact, addicted to losing a little bit.
Oh, sure. I think there are people willing to lose, but I think if you're willing to lose for being who you are and what you believe and what principles you're standing up for, that I think that's a refreshing good thing. If you're solely focused on just some kind of ambition that's not a policy ambition, that's not what you think that is best for the country,
right,
then I think you'll make bad decisions.
Well,
ultimately, in the
long run.
Just
to press you on that point, because the Obama folks have used the term nihilistic for some of these folks. I mean, do you feel that there is a strain in your party that is just no on everything?
No, I think what you have is a reaction to the surge of liberal progressivism that we've seen from the Obama administration. I think you have a reaction to how far left the government has gone, the president has gone. Just remember what he did when he first came into office, when he had total control, and how far he took the country, and how jarring that was. Because he ran as a consensus maker, not red state, not blue state, but right. United States. I mean, he ran as a tonal moderate. He sounded moderate.
And he
sounded like he was going to bridge gaps.
But more than that.
And then when he got in office, as soon as he hit the ground, he went hard left and stayed there.
But you were one of the
few. And then he did the smash mouth politics.
Right.
Yeah, then he did the
Well, let's
the
talk pre-smash mouth, because I remember them telling me, the White House folks telling me, that if there's a guy that they like up on the Hill, somebody who they feel that they can communicate with, somebody who sort of intellectually Obama wants to spar with, it was you, right? Mm. Did that ever happen? Did that relationship ever really develop?
They don't do congressional outreach. I don't say that as a Republican. I don't think they do it with their own party either. That's not what they do.
Did you ever interact with the president in a non-spotlight situation? Have you guys ever just talked about stuff?
Yeah, we talked on the phone, sure.
And what do you think of him? I mean, and what's sort of the tenor of the conversation?
He's a smart guy, but he's so smart he doesn't know what he doesn't know. And I think I think he's got a real blind spot there. Plus, he's a dedicated progressive, liberal progressive, which I guess if you're liberal progressive, you love that. If you're a conservative like me, you don't like that. And so, and I also think that he is, I think he's dramatically abused the Constitution. And I think that is not in keeping with the office that he's sworn oath to. And so I believe that he has stretched the Constitution beyond its limits. He has really put a test a precedence for the executive branch. That's a dangerous, a bad precedence.
Right. Do you say this to him when you speak with him? And how does he?
I have said things.
How does he
this
react
to
that kind of thing?
He doesn't like it. He doesn't know. I have. Believe me, I've said a few things to him. He doesn't like it. I think he just doesn't know what he doesn't know. And
in regards to what? In sort of budget stuff?
Lots of things. And so
that sounds to me like
I think he's.
Intellectual arrogance, essentially, is what you're...
Yeah.
Well, you could say those words, but anyway. Makes it better.
That's why I let you say.
But have you ever had any one-on-one interaction with Hillary?
A few times. I think I went over there and had breakfast once or twice.
To the...
When I was budget chair, when she was Secretary of State.
And what were those interactions like?
Good, she's pleasant. I've always had pleasant interactions with her. Nothing... in great depth.
Do you view her as being sort of as hard, to use your terms, as hard left as Obama? Do you think she's a little less progressive, a little more?
No, I think she's a progressive. I think she's just better at covering their tracks.
Yeah.
I think you look at who she really is from 1993, healthcare. So I think she is. I think she is that progressive. And I think a Hillary Clinton presidency would be nothing more than a third Obama term.
Have you ever considered voting for a Democrat? I mean, would there,
Yeah, I voted for Les Aspin once. He's one of my predecessors when I was, 18 or 20. I can't remember what, but when I was a young guy, I voted for him once.
Do you think the Democratic Party's gotten too
well?
Far
I thought
away
I saw from... I saw Les Aspin as helping Reagan with his defense bill, though.
As he really did. Yeah.
Oh, MX missile and all that. So I saw Les. He was, like I said, our guy from our district. I saw him as a Democrat helping Reagan, and so I voted for him one time because I met his opponent, and I decided to vote for Les.
Would you do that again? Like, if you
I voted for my sheriff. He's Democrat.
Really?
Yeah. He's lives two blocks from me. He's a friend of mine.
His last name isn't Ryan, is it?
No, it's Foden.
Yeah. Just wanted to check on that one. So in terms of you decided not to run, and there are any number of people in the party who thought you should have run. Why did you make that decision?
A lot of people wanted to. It was very nice. A couple of reasons. Stage in life, I think, is a big part of it. My kids are 11, 12, 13. Or 10, 11, and 13, excuse me. And I can do a lot right here. I got the job that I'd always planned on trying to get. You know, I didn't run for the Senate in the past because I wanted to do this job, Ways and Means. It's the committee in charge of our health care laws, our tax laws, our trade laws, our welfare laws, and some of our retirement programs. It's the committee. These are the laws you have to fix if you're going to prevent a debt crisis, if you're going to replace Obamacare, if you're going to do tax reform, and if you're going to make a big dent on poverty from a federal perspective by moving people from welfare to work, and if you're going to open up international trade. That, to me, is very exciting. It's what I want to work on. I think I can make a huge difference for the country where I am and for the party in the moment and be home on weekends.
Now, is there at any point, obviously this thing hasn't gotten into full swing yet, is there any point that you're looking at this or hearing some of these entrance announcements by these guys and saying to yourself, boy, I'd really like to be out there making that case?
I don't think like that. I made my decision, and my decision's made. I made it, you know, last year, near the end of the year. I gave it a lot of thought. I spent 2 years thinking about it. And I just know myself.
Is there some point in the future, perhaps, where you might run?
Again? Down the road, maybe, yeah. But I'm not one of these types who thinks I have to be president. I'm a policy person. I just want to get this stuff. I just want to get these things done. I want to do what I can to contribute to saving the country from the really awful trajectory that it's on, to help put us back on the trajectory. I wrote about this a lot. Yeah. I think of it as the American idea. And there's a lot of stuff I've been working on lately that I feel very strongly about that I think could have been jeopardized if I politicized it in a presidential campaign.
So in terms of, like, I also interviewed Elizabeth Warren recently, and one of the things that she said is, I'm absolutely not running for president, and I'll paraphrase her here, because I feel I can have a hell of a lot more leverage being on the outside, marshaling both the ideas and the people who support what I believe. Do you think that that's the role you're going to play? And pick one or two issues where you really want to have a dispositive impact on the debate.
Poverty. Well, on the poverty. Look, I come from Jack Kemp, right? So Jack was my mentor. I was really motivated and inspired by what he did. I don't think we've done nearly enough to pick up that mantle. I'm trying to do my best. So I spent a lot of time working on poverty issues. It's very important to me. I feel very strongly about it. I think I can help make a huge difference in it. And if I ran for president, all of that would have been politicized.
Wait, let me ask you about poverty, because I've covered poverty too. Do you, you know, it's funny, you get, when you go into communities, all folks ask for is more resources, including not-for-profits. I mean,
Not necessarily, but I'm with
you. But you know what I mean. I mean, it's a substantial part of the conversation. Do you see a space in where you would see increased spending on targeted anti-poverty programs?
Yeah, I mean, read
programs.
What I put out. There are some cases where I do see that. There are cases where I see. What I think we do is we just measure success by how much money we spend and how many programs we create and how many people go on those programs. Right. And look at where we are. I mean, we haven't moved the needle on poverty. We have 45 million people in poverty. So I'm doing a bill today. I just signed it a few minutes ago with Patty Murray on an evidence-based policy commission. The point is, among the things I think I can help do is change our measurement and our emphasis on these programs to outcomes measurement. So we measure success based on outcomes and results.
Which is much more prevalent in the not-for-profit world.
Yeah, it is. And so there are so you can go out and identify. We could talk about this for a long time. Okay, you can talk. You know, we need to switch to an outcomes-based approach, and we need to emphasize work. We need to emphasize upward mobility.
Right.
So the point I'm making in all of this is, I think there's a great space to be filled of our party being the party of solutions, of ideas, of setting the agenda, not just reacting to this last president, but to saying, here's where we're going to take the country, elect us. So I think I can help get us the kind of election that we have to have in this country to save the country, which is a choice election.
But there's also the tonal issue, right? And Rand Paul's also spoken about this too. Republicans, so, and you know this better than anybody, so many Republicans don't speak your language on this thing. I mean, how can you, do you think you can get people? I mean, clearly you've had these conversations with people.
Yeah, what I tell people is get out in the neighborhoods, get out in the communities.
They don't. A lot of people don't.
No, I know. And so that's, that's one of the reasons why I put this comeback video out. I was a part of putting this comeback video out. You can go to opportunitylives.com and watch the comeback miniseries, something that we worked on for a couple of years. And my goal with that is to just inspire people to get involved in their communities and see these stories for themselves. And to my fellow members of Congress and fellow public servants, go do this yourself and be inspired and understand, and then just it will make you better. It will make you a better policymaker. It will make you a better person. And those kinds of things I think are really important.
What kind of responses do you get? Are people, you know, you can't get overwhelmingly positive responses. A lot of people are in districts where this wouldn't necessarily fly, right?
I get positive responses. It's just, like you say, people come from different parts of the country and don't see it or know it as much. And I get positive responses. I would disagree with that. I don't get blowback at all. Most people say, thanks you for doing this. I'm glad you're doing this. What can I do to get involved? That's typically what I get.
In terms of the race, obviously, we don't know who is going to be in the race. Are there any candidates that you like what they've? I'm not going to ask you specifically who you're going to support. I presume.
I'm chairing the presidential trust, so I got to be neutral. That requires my.
And neutrality. You will be neutral throughout the entire.
I'm chairing the presidential trust. That's the general fund.
Gotcha.
For the nominee for the general election. So that's my title. That's my job. So that requires neutrality because we get support from everybody's supporters.
So let me hit you from a different angle on that. Is there anything you've heard from either any of the candidates who've announced or any who might announce that you thought was particularly interesting?
They're
all fantastic.
Yeah, they're all
they?
Fantastic.
Great.
They say great things. Nice try.
Well, you know, what the hell. In terms of getting back to Hillary a little bit, because, I covered her for a long time in 2008 and 2000.
Oh, were you on her on the plane?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah.
I was in two near, I'm not a happy flyer.
Best compliment I got from doing that, you know Janet Hook?
Oh, of course, yeah.
So I've known her a long time. She's a great lady.
Great reporter.
Yeah, great reporter. And I'd see her down in the gym in like the Iowa Marriott and the Des Moines Marriott and all that stuff. And she said, hey, I'm signing off. I'm going to be off the plane. I'm like, you've been with us a month. What happened? She's like, you know, you're going to have a few more people leave. I said, why? What happened? She's like, you don't gaff. You know.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. So they're, you don't gaff much. You're not making news unless you want to make the news. And I'm like, I'm going to take that as an enormous compliment. She said, you should. It was nice seeing you. I'll see you after the election.
Well, Hillary.
Something like that.
She
said something like that to me.
I did a first-person piece on
I'm
Hillary.
I'm paraphrasing the conversation, but she basically said that.
That
as a big compliment.
The other thing Hillary, the huge mistake that Hillary made in 08, just sort of like tactically, was she'd do 6-7 events a day. And by the time you got to the fourth or fifth event, I and my best friend, who was also covering the race with me, we would sleep in the bus until the fourth event. And then you'd go, everyone else would be completely burned out and totally desensitized. And that's when she would make the mistake at the
because she was tired, yeah.
Yeah, I'm the one who brought, she made the, remember she talked about the corkscrew landing in Bosnia?
Yeah.
That was at like this, that was at 8:30 at night in like Iowa City, you know? I mean, as a candidate, I mean, did you obviously observe the 08 race. Were you impressed by anything that she did? Did you
think? In the 08 race?
Yeah, in the 08 race.
I don't know. Was I impressed by anything she did? Not really. I really can't, honestly, I just can't think of anything.
So you don't think she's going to be a tough draw for you guys?
No, she's going to have money and she has name. I do think that she's very beatable. I know that's not conventional wisdom. I think she's very beatable because she's a third Obama term. She is not her husband. In that, I just don't think she has the kind of charisma that people look for. And I think her record is a terrible record. She was the architect of the Obama foreign policy for the first half of his presidency, which is a total disaster.
Right.
Russia, I mean, it can go on and on. So I think she has a bad track record of foreign policy failures. When she was first lady, she was the architect of socialized medicine. And I just don't think that that's going to fly.
Okay. Well, the one last thing I'll leave you on is there's just a lot of There is a lot of anti-Hillary talk out there, and you know, clearly you guys have a very distinct target here in the 2016 race. Is there the danger, though, of overshooting the runway here and getting mean? Like, I'll give you an example. Like, Eric Erickson from Red State is out there talking in really blunt terms about her being "quote unquote" an old lady. Do you think there's a real danger in like talking so negatively about her?
If we win this race, which I think we will win this race, we'll win it because of our ideas. We'll win it because of our agenda. We'll win it because we have better solutions, not because of any frustrations or any kind of criticisms. There'll be plenty to criticize of her policies, of her track record, of her ideas. We will win because we will give the country a better choice for the direction of this country. My goal is to help contribute to framing that choice, to preparing that choice, to getting that agenda ready, so that in 2017 we can fix this country.
What would you say to your fellow Republicans about tone? Because you very much about tone.
Yeah, that's one of the things I learned too in 2012. And just, I think it's just important to get around and listen to people who don't agree with you, and go to just various different communities. I think that's really important. And I think that matters. I'm from Wisconsin, so we kind of are normally like that anyway. It's kind of Midwest nice, people call it. So this is kind of how people like where I come from are. Tone is, the way I look at this is you have to be inclusive. You have to be aspirational. You got to be hopeful. And you got to give people a sense of why they want to vote for you, not against the other person.
All right. Great talking to you.
Yeah, you bet.
That was fun.
Yeah. Nice seeing you again.
Good seeing you.